This is WBCRLP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to keep the station improving and serving you, our community. On today's Farm and Garden Show with J. Allison Mosqueriello and Bill Taylor, we talk with Bresia McCracken of Helia Native Nursery to discuss native plants and how to encourage them.
First, some upcoming events. BerkshireGrown.org is the place to find information on all the local farmers markets. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to revive this community resource. Contact the
Great
Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Here are some of the markets. Millerton Farmers Market, Millerton Methodist Church, 6 Duchess Avenue, Millerton, New York. Saturdays, 10 to 2, year-round. Winter Farmers Markets. Hoosie Dome, also known as Housatonic Community Center, 1064 Main Street, Housatonic, Massachusetts. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays as follows. March 15th, April 19th. Vendors offer an abundance of locally grown food, including fresh greens, winter squash, root crops, apples, meat, cheese, jam, honey and maple syrup, baked goods, and more. Local artisan crafters round out the market's offerings, and each market features live music. Markets welcome snap and hip. From November to April, the Pittsfield Winter Market runs monthly at the Zion Lutheran Church next to the Pittsfield Common. Saturday, April 12th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Information on these markets can be found at berkshiregrown.org.
Along with information for summer markets.
Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics, even in winter. The website is berkshirebotanical.org/events, has listings. Phone is 413-298-3926, and email is info@berkshirebotanical.org. 9 years ago, Helia Native Nursery was founded by horticulturist and landscape designer Bresia McCracken. After the sale of Project Native, a nonprofit where she was chief landscape designer for 10 years, the founding of Helia Native Nursery was a solution to continue her and Project Native's mission to save unique Berkshire native plant seed and propagate plants from those seeds to be sold to landscape design clients and the public, part of an effort to restore and expand the strained ecosystem in the Berkshires. And we're delighted to have her with us today.
Good morning, Bresia, like the flower freesia.
Bresia, what a beautiful name.
Thank you. It's Gaelic.
That's what I thought. And I looked online to see how it was pronounced.
Right. Yeah.
And they said bridge. It was the English.
Bridey is how some people pronounce it in the old country, but not my parents.
Okay. Well, I'm going with your parents.
Right.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Because Monday mornings are so chaotic here, but I'm
So welcome, Bresia. How did you get passionate about growing and promoting native plants?
Great question. I really got inspired by working with Project Native. I was a designer with them, and that's when I really started to contextualize and understand the importance of native plants. Also, the potential to involve them as a sophisticated plant choice as a landscape designer. And that really excited me. And seeing how people got excited about being stewards of the land and how you could link design with stewardship, that really excited me. And I had been a ecology major and a biology major and grown up on the land, really restoring ecosystems and wetlands and forests with my father. So I had deep roots in it. And then that kind of put all the pieces together, and seeing individuals become passionate about stewardship really made me feel like this is it for me.
That's so wonderful. Yeah. And you know, I love what you said. You had deep roots in it. following, you know, it just brings back the idea and the concept that we are all part of this landscape. We are all part of it. We grow, I mean, even if we don't grow up here, we learn to be here and adapt like plants do.
And when I look at your plant list, it brings back memories of experiences with those plants. So it's really, really beautiful thing.
I have such an extensive list of plants. I know we can talk about more of that, but Bill has a question.
Tell our listeners about the importance of raising native plants in the microclimates in regions where they will be planted out. People say, I'm going to plant a native plant, and they have, say, a mountainous rocky soil, and they want to plant Joe Pieweed, which likes it wet.
Sure. And I think that's really a two-part question. Let's go back to making sure that you have the right plant. So part of that is about making sure that when you are planting a native plant, that it is native to here, not just native to, let's say, North America. And then the other thing that's really important about that is making sure that the genetic information is from this region, and ideally really from this county or this bioregion. Because when you take a native plant, they're not all adapted the same. They're not all going to perform the same in the environment. They're not going to be as resilient. So first, it's the actual Joe Pie that you're putting in. Let's make sure that that Joe Pie, for instance, is from the Berkshire Taconic region and not from, let's say, Missouri or South Carolina. Because that's what happens when native plants get hot. Vendors buy them in from whoever's growing them. Well, they have totally different genetic information than the Joe Pie from here. And then back to your question, part two of that is, where do we plant those plants? So how are we listening to the land and the invitation of the land and the ecosystem that's around it, or the natural community that's around it? And how are we planting those plants that support that natural community, that are not only within the soil and the light conditions and the water conditions, right, but in that natural community? And so then that means we stop saying, God, I really want Joe Pie and I have this rocky slope, and trying to force them to exist together, when really that will take a lot of maintenance, a lot of inputs.
Yes.
But then we say, what does want to grow in this unusual rocky slope? This is a really exciting challenge. And then where do I have some soggy soils that aren't so well drained, that maybe I could let that Joe Pie really shine in the way that it's able to grow in wet, wet conditions or dry conditions? And I think it takes a moment to step back and to not put our desire and our will first, but to step back into creativity and listening, and to say, what is the opportunity here? This is really exciting. It's different than I thought. So I'm going to really co-create.
And also something you mentioned that's very, very important. So we have the soggy soil, and we're going to get our Joe Pieweed. We want to know also, who does Joe Pieweed like to grow with? The companions, as you said, co-creating. It's not just, like I said, that willful thing. Oh, I've got to have a hydrangea, or I've got to have a native rhododendron. What does it like? Who does it like to hang out with?
That's right. And then when we start planting, what made me so passionate about this is we start planting ecosystems and communities. And so even if it visually looks like a garden, it creates and behaves like an ecosystem. So the nutrients are being shared between the root system. The one plant is supporting one part of the life cycle, let's say the caterpillar, where another plant is supporting the butterfly. And so they are behaving in this way of mutual support. So then what you have is a thriving environment. And what I saw is that makes a thriving human.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very, very different than when we just design and we decorate and we have a separation between that. And it takes a lot of inputs to maintain our design and our decoration. And that is a very different human experience.
It's a little bit like putting on makeup.
Right. Exactly. Versus doing that incredible breath work that makes you shine from the inside out.
From the inside out. Right.
What practices make you stand out from other nurseries? How do you work with people when someone orders a bunch of plants from you?
It can go several different ways. One is that the person is a designer or a informed land owner. They know exactly what they want. So they can order plants from the nursery and then we will custom grow them up. Or sometimes we have them in our stock and we can fill that order right away. So what that would mean is that we would be growing them up with the native ecotypes, the genetic information of the plants here. And so when they put that plant into the garden, they are really becoming a in situ seed bank. They are saving that genetic information in each one of their gardens. And as the wind blows, it blows those seeds around. As the seeds drop through the seasons, they actually fall into the soil. And many, many seeds can sit dormant in the soil for years, decades, up to 100 years. So then those become seeds that next time there's disturbance, those might germinate instead of, let's say, an invasive seed. That's what was dropping down and that's what was germinating. So you become part of a really important process. And then sometimes when somebody calls, they are looking for specific plants for specific conditions, and we'll recommend that. And the same thing when people come down to the nursery, there's lots of people who are there to help you to select plants that will work visually and ecologically. And so we're always looking at those two in tandem. So that's something that we offer. And then one of the things that sets us apart is that we are incredibly mission driven. We are about humans and nature growing together, and that understanding that it is not over, that we have power and choice, and that everything that we do is significant. Even though it might be one seed in the right direction, it might be one plant in the right direction, that's significant. And we really have the ability to make positive change in the environment. We run our nursery like that. We are working with the seasons. We're not heating our greenhouse. We're not putting in a lot of extra carbon into the ecosystem by running propane, by electric, by any of those things. We actually offset all the CO2 emissions from our vehicles by planting trees every year and then offering that to the community to plant trees to offset their own vehicles. So everything that we're doing, we're looking at how can we be in harmony with nature? How can we behave like an ecosystem? And then a lot of our plants, not only are we growing native ecotypes, part of the nursery industry is something called pricking out, which is you have a big seed flat and then you prick out all your seeds and you put them into cells and you grow them up into plugs and then they grow into pots. So we go into our meadows and we prick out from our meadows, which means that the winter and the spring and all of the natural growing conditions germinated those seeds for that year, because all the seeds have different genetic information. And based on those winter conditions and the summer conditions, those seeds germinated from that echinacea, or let's say Monarda or Joe Pye or any of those other plants. And so we're allowing nature that year to select who she germinates. And then we grow those out. And that's very different than when you are growing out a flat and they are going to break dormancy in a greenhouse. And then you need to produce. And so that week you're pricking out everybody who germinated that week and you're throwing out all the late germinators and you're throwing out all of the wet germinators. So we allow that selectivity to happen with nature.
Wow.
I love that. So I have a question for you because this is so exciting. I love that you say you don't heat your greenhouse. That begs the question, what's growing in your greenhouse without heat during our Berkshire winter, which I say goes 6 to 8 months?
Right. Well, we have two different greenhouses. We have a greenhouse that we grow our own vegetables in.
Right.
And in the winter, that's when we have things growing in there, right? So we have chamomile, we have kale, we have radishes, we have parsley, we have celery, we have root vegetables, carrots and beets. So those are doing their winter slow thing.
Not heated?
We have solar gain, just okay. The sun.
Okay.
And they grow slowly.
Okay.
And that's in that greenhouse. And then in our propagation houses that we use for the native nursery, we use them as a cold stratification during the winter. We want them to be as cold as possible because the way that our seeds break dormancy is a cold, moist stratification, the majority of the seeds. And so we have them dormant in the greenhouses going through that process naturally. We don't put them in the refrigerator. We let them go through that process naturally. And many times, actually, we have to go out and shovel snow and put them on all of the seed trays to keep them cold enough for long enough until we can actually start to make it a warm greenhouse. So, in about 2 weeks,
This was recorded on March 3rd.
we will close up the doors on the greenhouse. We'll stop shoveling snow into there. And then it will get to be about 80 degrees just naturally with solar gain if the sun is out. If the sun isn't out, then it stays pretty cold in there. It might only be 40. But then that sun is there. A lot of days we get up to 80 degrees, 90 degrees in there. That's slowly breaking dormancy, helping those plants to say it's time to wake up. But we actually, oddly enough, we are fighting to keep it cold enough for our native plants right now
Oh, wow.
because we don't have a long enough winter anymore to get cold stratification for a lot of our species.
Oh, that's very interesting because I've heard people say that it has changed so much.
It seems to become more like we both grew up on coastal Connecticut, down near the Sound, and it's not that much colder up here anymore than it was then. I mean, I remember minus 10 down there in the 60s and 70s.
One more question, though, going back just a little bit. Okay, so let's just say, because I love your mission and I'm glad you're mission driven because it totally speaks to my heart. We can do things, we can improve what's going on. So I'm Jay Consumer walking into your incredible place and I'm saying, oh, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. Is someone actually going to interact with me and saying, you know, Jay, that's a nice idea, but there might be a better idea than that. Will somebody actually do a little guiding and say, that's probably not going to grow so well where you are? Maybe you want to consider these.
Right. Absolutely. Many times people will say, so tell me a little bit about your growing conditions, especially when people are picking plants that we know, wow, this loves it hot and dry, and that loves it sopping wet, and this loves it, and these two, they are not all going to go together. So somebody will absolutely say, tell me a little bit more about your growing conditions. Tell me about the sunlight. Tell me about the moisture, and then guide you towards. These are some plants that might be ideal for you when you're looking for bloom times in July. And so let's move over here. And these are three or four selections that you might want to consider. Absolutely. Directing people towards what's going to be successful because I'm all about success. Even if you start slow and you have successes, then you're going to build and that's going to build momentum. And that momentum is going to build a lot of excitement and empowerment. And then you're going to repeat that process, right? So if we don't engage and educate, then you're going to say, ah, these native plants, they look like weeds, they didn't work. We
It
are certainly about making sure that each person have something that does really work in those conditions. And then one of the really great things about native plants is there are visually stunning native plants, just like there's visually stunning non-native plants. And oddly enough, for a very long time, in particular in England, in their garden scene, and in Europe, American native plants were the hot ticket. So it's all about different plants a lot of times that people are looking for and what's hot and new. And there's a lot of native plants people haven't used before in their gardens that are visually stunning and that, again, while being stunning, while being lower maintenance, while being easy to plant and low water needs, they are biologically serving all of the insects and the birds and the, so you get all of these layered effects.
I love that. It makes me so happy.
Your first image was of pricking the plant out of the natural environment, and then the other one was propagating in the greenhouse. Why use the greenhouse? Is it keeping rodents away or a little more controlled environment so that you're not just pulling things out of the meadow? I'm wondering about your process.
So we do all different types. So we are looking at growing seeds in the greenhouse. We're looking at also propagating seeds and pricking them out from the natural environment. And we're blending those two at the same time. Mm-hmm. So for instance, we will have a whole catalog of seeds that are cold stratifying in the greenhouse over the winter. And then some of those we will prick out, and those are actually for next year. And then we also will go into a meadow and work from there and wild harvest from there. One of the nice things too is that we have 109 acres here on Sky Meadow Farm.
Beautiful.
And so we can go on a lot of our tractor roads and we can harvest just from the actual wheel ruts. We harvest a lot of our ferns. So in the springtime when they're dormant before they've come up, we just harvest them out of the road and then we can grow those up, right? So we're looking again at where are there opportunities where by our actions, we are really making this not habitable for plants and we can start to just harvest from there. So we do a combination of more of a traditional nursery. Again, very, very, very low carbon inputs, and then very earth-based cycles of nature. And those two come together, and that's our model of how we're working.
Oh, that's fantastic. Your organic compost and potting mixes, do you produce those yourself, or do you purchase them in? And what feedstocks go into the compost?
So we do not produce our own compost. We do work with a local farm that grows an organic nursery mix. So we use that. And that's actually a large part of our model is I like to be, let's say I'm in a forest and I'm an oak tree. I don't want to be an oak tree, a maple tree, and a birch tree. I want to be the best oak tree I can be and share my resources with the maple and the birch. So I'm going to support the farmer that I really love what they're doing and they do it better and not try and do it myself.
Sure.
Likewise, many times I will buy in what we call native neighbors. So they're not native to the Berkshire Taconic region, but they are native to New England. I'm going to buy that and support another nursery who's doing a great job growing their local ecotypes that are local down in, let's say, the Pioneer Valley, or let's say New Hampshire or somewhere else that they're really growing well. And I'm going to support every farmer and grower that I know who's doing something that I love. I'm going to support them in them doing it better than me. And then I'm going to do what I do best, right? Which is grow Berkshire Taconic native plants. And again, we're looking at getting native plants that are rare and endangered off the endangered species list. This plant is rare and endangered. How can we produce enough seed of this? How can we grow enough of it so that it's not on that list anymore, right? We're on our fifth plant that we're working.
Wow.
This is completely possible.
Yes.
Right?
How
so
many plants
we are growing and going and moving with this actively?
How many plants are on that endangered list? I didn't get a chance to mark them all off.
We grow probably over 50 different plants that are on the rare and endangered species list, maybe even more than that. But we have large amounts of seed and we focus on one or two plants every year to really get a large seed bank and make sure that those are all over the region.
Oh, that's fantastic. Do you have any recommendations? One of the things that we did when we lived in California, just for helping bring in the pollinators and things, was we did the seed bombs. You know, it's really fun. Do you have certain mixes that you would say, hey, this is going to be great for a meadow mix, pollinator attracting. For those people who, like me, were a little slow to convert lawn into meadow and then realize the benefits that first year I did it. It was amazing.
Right.
It's like, oh my God, there's so much life here. It's crazy.
Totally. Absolutely. So, yes, I love seed bombs. They're very fun. Many times we have a seed bomb making workshop on the farm during the season. It's very fun. And I love making them with kiddos who can use them after school and throw them in vacant lots. One year we had a bike tour come through and we gave them to all the bikers. And so as they bike down the roads of the Berkshire County, they just threw seed bombs everywhere. It was very fun.
Oh, how wonderful.
So yeah, so that we do that. It's lots of fun. And then we do have a seed mix that's blended already for the Berkshires. So that's going to have the genetic, the ecotypes of those plants. So it's going to be native plants with the native ecotype. And it's blended to both grow in, it's a full sun meadow, but slightly wetter soils or slightly drier soils. So it has a nice diversity in that seed mix where people will be able to put that in most of our soils here. And that's something that we have on hand and it's always blended and available for people. So everybody doesn't have to design that. The Berkshire Meadow Mix is actually designed for leach fields as well. So
Great.
people who are putting in a new leach field, all of those, the root systems are safe for leach fields and septic systems, which is great, right? Because that's a really nice opportunity. A lot of times in our backyards, we have these odd mounds that look like leach fields. And it's a great opportunity to put a meadow there. It blends it. It also gets rid of the venting pipe visually, and it's a great place to bring some biodiversity to your backyard. And then we also have a northeastern seed mix that is working with, again, what I would call native neighbors, beautiful native plants that are native just a little bit farther south and north. And that is a lot broader plant list. And they're both focused on pollinators. They're both
Yes.
focused on all of our pollinators. So we're focusing on our native bees. We're focusing on our native butterflies predominantly. And then we're looking at the rest of the pollinators. And again, when we are attracting insects to our ecosystem, that also means we're feeding birds, we're feeding foxes, we're feeding bears. We start feeding everything when we attract insects,
All
which is
my favorite neighbors.
Exactly.
I love them.
Back to the endangered plants. I remember hearing that golden seal is an herb that's used a lot and it's also endangered, and that you can use barberry, which is an invasive, but it has similar properties. So encouraging people to find alternatives to over-harvesting the endangered plants, because that's how golden seal, I think, got endangered, was harvesting for the herbal properties. So I'm just wondering if there are other examples of that. And I was curious if golden seal was one of the ones that you were working with.
Yes, great question. Right now, golden seal, it's an incredible plant and such an incredible ally. So we are not yet working with that plant. I think part of why it is endangered is because of overharvest. Part of it is also that it is a slower plant to grow and grows in woodland understories. That will be one that we will probably start to work with in a couple of years. Right now, we're working a lot with more of the meadow plants. So, grape lobelia, Veronica castrum, some of those more full sun and more adaptive plants that I can get into a lot of environments. And then I think what you also bring up is an interesting idea, which is what are the opportunities that we have? So, we want to look at the world in a different way. I want to look at the world in a different way and give that opportunity to people. So, a lot of these invasive plants, as you were saying, do they have medicinal properties that we can take advantage of the fact that they don't have competition, that they do reproduce very quickly, that we can harvest them and take advantage of those properties? And we taught a wonderful, wonderful class on the farm of harvesting and making medicinal tinctures out of invasive plants.
Oh, you're
And it
speaking in our
was
language.
so much fun. And they're so delicious to eat and really interesting. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity there to see how can we utilize these plants that are very aggressive in these ecosystems, but how can we bring them into balance? And how can we work with the more delicate plants? How can we allow them to actually be left, for instance, the golden seal? How can we allow that to be left in the woodland for the native bee to actually use as its life cycle versus our medicine?
And that's a good question. Yeah. How can you do that? I mean, I love that. That's a big question.
Just want to get some contact information from Brija Williams McCracken of Helium
Native Nursery.
Yeah, so we are located in Alford, Massachusetts, and that's really between Great Barrington and West Stockbridge. We're located on 95 East Road, beautiful farm there. We always welcome visitors. And our website is helianativenursery.com. And then you can email us as well. We love to talk to other native plant enthusiasts.
Great. Wonderful.
I want to delve a little more deeply into that big question, and maybe you can give us a little bit of insight. How can we allow those more delicate, fragile plants to not only just survive, but thrive in the woodlands? I love our woods. We don't have that many acres of it, but whatever we do, I feel very privileged that we have it. What would you suggest is a good modality? What could we put in our woodlands, and what could we do to nurture them and make sure that they are surviving?
Mm-hmm. One of the opportunities we have is to look at a new answer. So sometimes we go to the answer that's the easy answer, the one that we know. And so we don't delve a lot deeper than that. Right. But for instance, one of the best sources we have for vitamin C are white pine needles, right? And we talk about in the winter, we got to get our vitamin C and let's get our vitamin C. And we go for citrus. We don't need citrus. Right in New England, white pine needles are a tremendous source of vitamin C. Right.
Are you talking about those little edges, the little green edges that you chew on?
The pine needle.
Yeah, you can just have pine needle tea. It's amazing. It's so good for you. So that's our looking at and believing. So for me, the first thing is I always believe deeply that although I don't feel like the answer is there, it's just I haven't actually been looking in the right place, or I haven't learned and listened enough to the ecosystem. And so that's an example where right away you can switch it around and you're like, oh, of course, New England has what I need. In a woodland, same thing. If we're looking at a plant that we're using for our immune system or we're using for some other medicinal use, there's always going to be a layered effect in nature. Some other plant is also going to provide that. So we can start to look at what else is providing that for me. What else is offering that so that it's not an either or, but it's an and with information. And I think that that starts to make it feel like, ah, it's not that it's people versus nature or we've ruined the planet, so you move on. And I feel like we have a lot of disempowering beliefs around the environment and our own engagement with the environment as human beings. And when we start to get into an empowered place and say, ah, I know there's a beautiful answer. What is it? So the woodland is a layered community. So we're going to have always these different layers in it. And when we talk about restoring, a lot of times we're restoring the understory of a forest. And that's where we have a lot of opportunities of restoring it. And we can still have huge engagement with that forest by just walking on the paths, say, or by removing the disturbance adapted plants, or what we would also call invasive plants, right? They're disturbance adapted, and planting in those native plants, those rarer plants that would be in there. And then going through and using that perhaps more as a contemplative space than an active, engaged sports space. Right. You might walk through it and you might engage with it in a different way.
So I have a question. Thank you, because that's so beautiful. It's a really wonderful prescription of what to do. I love that it's not about invading being ourselves, the invader, but rather being this observer and delighter, enjoying. My mind has questions. What might I see in terms of some of the native plants that would be in a healthy woodland that has some wetland in it? What would be some of those plants that I would wish to see or be happy to encourage growth in?
Right. What you would see in the spring is early in the spring, before the trees leaf out, you're going to see beautiful woodland understory spring ephemerals. So you might see bloodroot, which is a beautiful white flower that comes up early, early in the spring. You might see trillium. Later on, you might see golden Alexander or zizia. You might see woodland phlox that are growing there. So you're going to see in the woodland, the flowers are predominantly going to flower early in the spring, and they're going to be typically only about a foot tall. And then you're going to see a lot of times they're all going to flush out into their greenery when the trees get their green leaves on them. And then you're going to see ferns a lot of times during the midsummer. Or you might also see a lot of the woodland grasses. Perhaps you'll see the hair grass, or you would see carexes, the sedges. They kind of look like light green, feathery grasses. Mm-hmm. They're about 4 to 6 inches tall, very low, right? So that's going to be that woodland understory. And then again, in the fall, you're going to see, perhaps you see more flowers in the woodland again. So you might see zigzag goldenrod, which is, again, a beautiful short goldenrod. And you might see blue wood asters or white wood asters. Mm. So they are going to be giving a final nectar source for the bees. And they're going to be providing flowers. Again, as we start to get more sunlight into the woodland, we start to get more flowers again. And then all of that really goes dormant. The woodland understory typically disappears in New England, and all of that goes dormant and then starts up very, very early. In those wetter conditions, you might have skunk cabbage coming out early if you have some sunlight. You might have ostrich ferns. They grow very well in the wet understory. And a lot of probably mosses, something you wouldn't plant but might come in. And what's really beautiful is when you sometimes go into undisturbed woodlands, they're very soft and spongy under your feet.
Yeah.
There's so much play in that soil. It's deep soil or it's deep moss.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just painted a beautiful painting. You just took me right there. And now, I'm so glad.
Now, as things change, as the climate warms up, what are your thoughts about what are future native plants and what plants will we lose? What will we potentially gain in our microclimate?
Yeah, that's something that I think about a lot, and that we take our role very seriously as growers of these plants and as the people who are making sure they're here into the future. And we do engage, like I was saying, with what I would call adaptive migration, right? So as plants, typically they have moved up and down the eastern seaboard as the ice came up and receded. And so several times we had our trees really change where they were growing. We had a lot of the understory really change where it was growing. And what we had at that time was we had contiguous ecosystems. Now we have roads and asphalt and lawn between those. So I feel like when I'm planting those native plants, I do include those native neighbors, both the ones farther south and the ones farther north, so that I will give an opportunity for those plants to be in the ecosystem and that seed to be there. Now, I do not do that in a true ecosystem. For instance, if I was restoring a wetland or mm-hmm. a forest, I would only use the native plants from this region in that ecosystem. When I'm designing what I would call the domestic zone, the area around somebody's house and their area that they're engaging with a lot, that's where I would start to bring in those native neighbors. But I wouldn't actually put them in a true ecosystem because I still want my ecosystems to be our core habitat. And I don't believe we're not going to instantly lose our core habitats, but we will definitely, having some of those plants here will in some cases mean that those plants aren't going extinct where they are, right?
Yes.
A lot of the birds that are prairie birds and from the Midwest are actually here in New England because we have a lot of meadows and larger meadow tracts for them to be in where there's a lot more corn in a lot of those places. And of course, the Midwest is doing what they can to change that around. But we do end up being reservoirs, right? And I think it is important to realize that we might not just warm. We might erratically cool and warm. And what I'm seeing the problem for plants is that we're warming and cooling off tempo. So we have a very, very warm March or April, which causes the blooms, let's say, to break dormancy early. And then we get a regular cold snap. And so then all of those blooms are actually frosted and killed. And then we don't have any fruiting from that. And so that erraticness is what's causing, I think, the most disturbance. That's part of why I'm looking at saving different plants with different genes so that some of those plants that do fruit later or fruit earlier, we can have that. So every year we don't have a complete loss if we're working with, say, a clone.
Yes. So those mixes, those varieties of the cooler and the warmer abilities to thrive in different conditions, those would be in a mix that you would have, say, like a meadow mix?
Absolutely. Because again, all of the seeds that we're saving all have different codes in them as to when to break dormancy. They're not all the same genetic code. And so they will break dormancy early or late.
Right.
Depending on their code, because we have saved a huge breadth of code. And so we're seed banking. We seed bank on our farm, but then we also are able, because we have had over 20 years of work here in the Berkshires, and we have a partner. The Native Nursery works very closely with Helia Land Design, who's designing and working in all of these different places. We have seed banks in all over the area that we can save seed from, because all of our clients that we've been working with for so many years have meadows, have beautiful gardens, have forests that we can seed from and really get a breadth of biological information from there.
Oh, that's so fantastic. Great. I'm so glad that we met you.
I'm glad to meet you too. Yes.
So are you involved with NRCS Conservation Project or EQIP projects?
So we are not. I did work years ago. I worked for the Nature Conservancy and they worked a lot with those projects. That's not something that we've continued to work with. We don't actually work with any herbicide at all when we're doing restoration projects. And a lot of EQIP, I believe, and I could be wrong now, but that's one of the tools that they like to fund and utilize.
Yeah, we did get one and we didn't use herbicides, clear the area out and to get the plant in there. And I'm more into planting it without taking too much clearing, putting some mulch on it to give the shrub, I'm doing trees and shrubs, a head start, but not doing too much disturbance because that's just going to ask for trouble later. So I'm just wondering what your approach is when you're establishing a plant. How much do you clear an area? And how much you just stick the plant right in without really doing much disturbance at all, putting in a plug, you know, a plant rather than a seed or even with seeds too. How do you do that with seeds?
Sure. So each category needs its own way of being introduced. And so it's very successful to introduce trees and shrubs and really interplant them, if you will. So they can be interplanted with other species. And really, you're talking about sunlight. So if they are taller than the species around them, they're already going to get the sunlight and they're going to grow up to there. If they are shorter than the species around them, you might need to help them a little bit and water them in order for them to get enough nutrients in their root system until their root system has spread out in order for them to be able to grow in those conditions. So with shrubs and trees, I feel like interplanting is very successful. When you're introducing native shrubs or trees or perennials into a garden, interplanting is very, very successful. One of the areas that gets to be a little bit tricky is a lot of people want to change an old hayfield into a meadow and just interplant meadow plants into an old hayfield. That isn't very successful because that root system of the existing European pasture grasses is very, very established and will outcompete a small plug of a wildflower or something like that. So many times that's where when you're looking to create a meadow and you're looking to change either lawn or a hayfield to meadow, it is best to remove the lawn or the hayfield first and then plant, whether it's seed or a plant. And that can be done by sheet mulching. That can be done by burning the grasses. That can be done by using a sod cutter and removing that.
Did you say burning? Because that won't take the roots out, right?
No, but that will, oddly enough, by burning, again, you have to do this with the way that your town allows you to, but by burning off the grasses and putting down seed, you will see a large amount of wildflowers coming back. And you will see actually just by taking our meadows and removing the heavy dead grasses in the spring, you'll start to see much more diversity of wildflowers coming in from the seed bank. Different techniques of working with an area.
You probably knew that's what the Native Americans did. They call it cool burning. It's cultural burning. I love that. Because when we were in California after wildfires, we saw the most lush, incredible wildflowers that came in, and many people guessed that they'd been in the ground for many years. Amazing. Amazing.
Exactly.
So some towns will not give you a permit for that kind of burning. You can do a burn pile, but you can't really do that. So would you use a flame weeder other than changing the laws of the town?
Again, when we're talking about the scale that most people are working on, we're talking about a small area.
Right.
So you are talking about being able to use a weed torch or something like that. Absolutely. Versus, yes, we're not talking about a scale of a huge hay field. We're talking about a scale of more of a garden size area that you might change a lawn or part of a hay field for. And so again, repeat mowing is another technique. One of the fun things about having the farm now is that we have areas that we have burned, and you can see what happens a year, 2 years after that. We have areas that we've allowed just to grow back slowly on their own. And we have other areas that we have removed all of the vegetation and we have planted. So you're really able to see what the outcome is for each. And all of them are going to get you more diversity. Mm-hmm. I think really it's about what is your aesthetic goal and what is your tolerance and patience level, right? Sometimes it takes a lot of patience if you have a high aesthetic goal and you are modifying it slowly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's important to know.
I just read an article in Acres. Her name is Siobhan Griffin. She's from New Zealand. And she talked about how the megafauna that people have pretty much wiped out left things as a savanna. We didn't have deep forest in New England before people got here. So according to her thing, and same with Australia and other places that have become deserts because the megafauna become extinct. Some people think it's climactic change. She seems to think it's more human overhunting and that the really huge creatures, like a rodent the size of a car, they said would used to be around. I don't think we can bring the megafauna back, but people can do things with grazing. I'm just wondering if that approach, in addition to the flame weeding, the regular cultural burning, or the repeated mowing, if there's any place for those, or if you've seen any people doing that in our area to bring back more diversity?
Right. So we've worked with grazing when it comes to removing invasives in a large area, working with Scotch Highland cattle or working with goats. When you work with grazing, all of the grazing animals are going to encourage more grasses and discourage wildflowers.
Right.
So the more that you cut a lawn, or the more that you cut a meadow or you graze a meadow, the more that you are encouraging all the grasses to grow and the less that you cut. So again, one of the ways actually to get more floral diversity in a meadow is actually just to change the mowing regime and to back it off and mow once every 3 years. So for wildflowers, we're actually looking at reduced grazing. Again, if you're looking at bringing something back from having a lot of disturbance adapted plants to more of a grassland, then yes, grazing is great. But grazing really does predominantly direct us towards grasslands.
Even when you're moving them every day versus leaving them there a long time, because I know there's different things that happen with the different management.
We had sheep on our farm that we grazed, and because again, it takes that wildflower several months to grow a long enough stem and then to bud and then to flower and then to drop seed. And in that time, it has been munched. And
yes.
So that's why we need more than a year in order for that plant to actually go through and drop its seeds and for us to get more wildflowers. So can you move? Let's say that you wanted to work with livestock. You might have to leave an area ungrazed for a year or two and then move that livestock around.
Right.
We won't be doing that because we are in woodsland.
But we know people.
Even though I love sheep, I go to visit them. I want to ask you, just because I'm just going to have to move over to your place.
Right.
Do you happen to have a CSA program by any chance?
So we have had a really fun CSA. It's a meadow CSA program. So people can come and they can pick out from the wildflowers that are there. Let's say we have 5 different wildflowers for that week. They can pick out 3 that they want. And so it's a meadow CSA, or they can pick grasses that they want. And that's a way of, again, working with the same CSA model where you pick up what they have that week. Mm-hmm. That's looking at bringing out all the plugs that we're growing that week and giving people an opportunity to plant those in a meadow.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really lovely. My head is still stuck on one of the things that you were saying, let the grasses go for 3 years, don't mow for 3 years if you're going to really allow the wildflowers and native plants to go well. Did I hear that correctly? You said something about...
Would you do a dormant mowing each year or
you
after
just
the seed drop, or would you just not touch it?
Yeah. Just not touch it for 3 years? I mean,
right.
I do paths just so we can get to different places. But
right.
Would you just let that be? I can stop mowing. That's fine. I don't need to. But if I heard you correctly, you said something about 3 years.
Yes. So what we're looking at when we mow once every 3 years is we're looking at how do we stall the natural succession process, which is that our meadows are going to become a forest, right? And so when we cut once every 3 years, we're cutting the woodies, the little tree saplings, before they get so big that we can't cut them. And we are keeping it a meadow. We are pretending that we are fire or we are our tornado or something like that, right? So we are disturbing the area and bringing it back, or flood. We're getting rid of the trees. So that's something that we would do once every 3 years. And when we cut in the spring. So we recommend that everything is cut in the spring when it's dormant, because if you cut a meadow or a hayfield in the fall, mm-hmm. you are cutting all of the food that the birds need to eat, all of the seeds that they would eat, right? You're right. Also cutting many of the areas that our native bees and our native butterflies overwinter in. So they overwinter in the hollow stems and the pithy stems and the loose debris And so we are getting rid of their overwintering sites. And then we're getting rid of the insects that a lot of times, if you see those goldenrod galls, those little balls on the stems of the goldenrod, those are filled with insects that birds eat. So we're looking at how can we leave all that up? So we're supporting the winter life cycle of our insects and our birds. And then in the spring, we'll cut it down. So then again, we're only cutting in the springtime. It's very clear. Everything has dropped. It's very clear where you see your woodies. You just cut the woodies out of there and then you allow it to grow up. And sometimes there's so few woodies that we don't even cut the whole meadow. We just selectively cut the woodies that are there. Or some of our meadows have a lot of multiflora rose. That's, you know, an invasive plant. So we'll just go through and cut the multiflora rose. That's a technique. Another technique that's popular is to mow a third of your meadow each year so that you're not mowing it all, but you're just mowing a section. Mm-hmm. And then again, it's only to get rid of the woody plants. The perennials themselves do not need to be cut in order to be healthy.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. really good to know.
So spring, you would say before much has come up. So maybe like early April.
Mid-April.
So sometimes it's March, sometimes it's April. And so there's sometimes a time of year where the ground is still frozen, but all the snow has melted. And sometimes I look for that time period because you can easily go through and cut and mow. And then otherwise you wait till everything is soft and has woken up and you can go through and mow at that point. Now, the important thing is not to mow too late. So you don't want to start to mow as you get into May and June, because if you have a larger meadow, we do have ground nesting birds, right? Yes. So when you do have a large hay field or you do have a large meadow, you'll want to wait then. If you miss that window, you don't mow until after the 4th of July when the majority of the ground nesting birds have fledged. And if you want to be really, really safe, then you don't mow until really August when they've all fledged. But that 4th of July is one of the numbers that a lot of people use, especially when they have right here in the Berkshires. And we have a lot of conservation land where we're wanting to both conserve the land and still have it available for farmers to cut hay. So that's when farmers would come in and cut their first hay, would be after the 4th of July. So all those ground nesting birds have fledged, and then you can cut that hay from that, mm-hmm. which again is a different use than a wildflower meadow, but it's how we're trying to layer different uses of our different ecosystems.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time, Brisia. I could keep you on here all day long because I have questions about all these flowers, but I think I'm going to have to pay you a visit.
Yeah,
because... please, right?
How would we get to do that? You said you welcome visitors, but is that just May through September, or is that all year?
Right. So what we have is, because we are growing plants all the time and we have such a small nursery, we do have open farm weekends, and we'll have those on our website. We are open every weekend. We're Thursday through Saturday in May, and then the first two weekends in June. And then we're open one weekend a month throughout July, August, and September. So we're here all May and June, moving and grooving and planting a lot of plants. It's crazy time of year then. And then, yeah, you can always find us on our website. We have lots of information there. Or a lot of people now use Instagram. You can always find the information on Instagram. And then the rest of the time we are off in the woods planting or harvesting or doing things like that. So it is best for people to send an email or to come on those open farm days, because we won't necessarily be here.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful to know. Thank you so much.
Oh, is there anything we didn't ask?
I didn't ask you that you wanted to tell us.
Gosh, that's a great question. No, I feel like we had a wonderful conversation. Yeah.
And Helia Native Nursery contact information.
Oh, yes.
And how people would work if people wanted to get certain plants and maybe you don't have them now, how they would set up.
Like yellow giant hyssop.
Fabulous. Yes, our contact information is Helia Native Nursery.
L-I-A.
Yep, H-E-L-I-N and then Native Nursery at gmail.com. And then Again, our website is the same, helianativenursery.com. And then you can always call us, and the contact information is on the website. And then you'll get myself, or you'll get Jonathan, my husband. He's the manager of the nursery. Or you'll get somebody in our office who's very, very knowledgeable and has worked with us for a very long time. And then they'll let you know the next steps.
Great.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brisia.
And I know you've got lots of work to do. So we'll see you in the spring.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Thank you
thank
guys
you.
So much.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Ciao.
You.
Ciao.
But
for the future of seven generations.
This is WBCRLP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to keep the station improving and serving you, our community.